Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 7, 2017. President Kiir says his national dialogue will start in March. And a former advisor to Mr. Kiir says the dialogue should include everybody.
Who are the actors? Who are the forces that are causing chaos throughout the country? Call Kiir Mayardit, call Machar, Tenyi, call Lama, call whoever is there who says that he is not happy with the government. That is what inclusive means.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir says the national dialogue he announced late last year will start early next month. Speaking at a public rally in Yei town yesterday, the president said holding a national dialogue is the only way to end the ongoing conflict. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir traveled to Yei town yesterday to try to calm the fears of residents in the aftermath of several deadly attacks between government forces and identified armed groups. Speaking in Arabic at today's public rally, the president said holding a national dialogue is the only way to resolve all grievances of the South Sudanese people and to restore their faith in the government.
The dialogue that I declared recently is one of the means that will bring our people back home. It is going to start in March, so we only have 3 weeks to go. And when our parliamentarians return from their recess, that is the time we will sit down together so that we can talk about how to restore peace.
The president insists that the proposed national dialogue would be an open forum at which all issues affecting South Sudan would be addressed and resolved. Mr. Kiir appealed to armed groups fighting his government to lay down their arms and help develop South Sudan. He has this warning for those who do not heed his call.
If they don't listen to the voices that call for peace, I will declare war on them. I don't think there is anyone who can blame me for that. It is not the time for war now. Let's exhaust all means and ways of getting peace back to South Sudan.
President Kiir calls on the people of Yei to communicate the message of peace and urge all to support the national dialogue, including those who took up arms against the government in Yei. Regarding the violence that has occurred over the past few weeks and months in Yei River State, President offered his condolences to all families who have lost loved ones and those property was destroyed.
I want to extend my sincere condolences to all of you who have lost some family members and people who have lost their properties. I want to apologize to all of you. I am sorry for what happened.
Mr. Kiir is scheduled to return to the capital, Juba, on Friday. The audio in this report was provided courtesy of iRadio. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
A former advisor to President Salva Kiir says the proposed national dialogue will not achieve its desired effect. President Salva Kiir told South Sudanese last year that the aim of the dialogue is to usher a new era of peace, stability and prosperity. But Canon Clement Janda says dialogue must involve all parties, including those that have taken up arms against the Kiir administration. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Clement Janda was one of the founding members of the higher chamber of South Sudan's parliament, the Council of State's Council, after South Sudan gained its independence in 2011. Canon Janda resigned from his seat and fled the country in July following a surge in fighting in Juba between government forces and forces loyal to former first Vice President Riek Machar. Canon Janda says the definition of a dialogue is two or more parties talking about a common issue of which they don't necessarily share the same view. He says that is not happening.
If it is initiated by one person, it becomes a monologue. Monologue, one person talking to himself. In other words, what I've read in the papers, in the social media, is a group of people selected by the president. those will now be the president's people. There should be other people selected by other stakeholders who are around, many who don't necessarily agree with the state of affairs in Juba or South Sudan.
Kanon Janda says a dialogue is an invitation to all parties or stakeholders to the conflict who are allowed to nominate their own people taking part in the talks. He says the international community should also play a role in organizing a national dialogue.
The government of today cannot arrogate to itself the right of organizing the country without any due regard to the forces that are outside them. That is a problem. The government needs to be sensitive to every South Sudanese who has a view on how South Sudan should be run.
Kanun Janda says it is critical that all parties take part in the dialogue if it is going to succeed.
Inclusive means including everybody. One should be able to say who are the actors, who are the forces that are causing chaos throughout the country of South Sudan. Call them all. Call Kir Mayardit, call Machar Tenyi, call Lama, call whoever is there who says that he is not happy with the government. That is what inclusive means.
Late last year, President Kir nominated himself to lead the country's national dialogue, which he initiated. Mr. Kir issued a decree appointing a 42-member committee to develop the agenda of the dialogue per the agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan. He then appointed veteran South Sudanese politicians, including Abel Alier, Joseph Lago, and Francis Mading as advisors. Kanun Janda says the initiative should be led by a neutral body such as the African Union or the Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, so the dialogue is not biased in favor of one group or another. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The author of a new book entitled Breaking Sudan describes the general feeling of euphoria of independence in South Sudan and how its leaders were unwilling to admit that independence alone would not solve the deep-seated problems of the South Sudanese people. Jock Madud Jock tells Ayen Bior the early blueprints of the then Southern Sudan have never addressed the potential pitfalls of nation-building.
It was a failure in the sense that there was too much focus on building institutions of the state, which is not a bad idea. Of course, institutions matter, but there was a need for a dual project of building institutions as well as building a sense of collective nationhood and collective belonging, citizenship in the nation rather than citizenship in the region or ethnic group. The third major challenge would have been ensuring that the relationship between Sudan and South Sudan, once they have now become two countries, where South Sudan needed to focus on building cordial relationships with Sudan. And Sudan also needed to see that a destabilized South Sudan is not good for Sudan. And I think going forward, the two countries revisiting that relationship would be a major task, and it would be a solution to some of the intractable problems that remain both within each of them as well as between them.
Now, a government sympathizer or a government supporter might tell you that the issues that we're seeing today are just growing pains, that we're a young nation and we're trying to find our way in the international system. Is that an appropriate defense?
It may be. There's nobody who can discount the fact that the long history of independence has left a massive burden on the conscience, on the shoulders of the country, on the institutions of the country. So that impact often takes long for it to be massaged away. And so it may be a good argument, but at the same time, it is one thing to have a problem, such as a long history of struggle, which has left massive burden in the form of destruction of assets, illiteracy, and lack of infrastructure and so forth. Nobody can fault any government sympathizer in saying that, what were we going to do, since these were things we have inherited, and it takes time, long time, for this to be tackled. But it is one thing to have a problem. It is totally another to recognize that you have a problem and to think about ways to solve the problem. I think this has not been a priority question in the minds of leaders of South Sudan. I think recognizing that you have these problems and having charting a way forward, a plan, has not existed really in a practicable form.
In your book, you argue that Southern Sudan, or what was Southern Sudan, is not worse off, but Sudan is also worse off because of independence.
Certainly. Because of independence, both countries have lost in many ways, symbolic and substantive. In symbolic ways, Sudan was once a great African country, the biggest on the continent, that traversed and a gateway between north and south of the continent. It was in a position where it could become a formidable country on the continent and in the world. And so having broken it up meant that both countries have become all the more weaker.
That was author Jock Madud Jock, co-founder of the SAD Institute, speaking with Ayen Bior from New York earlier today. His new book, Breaking Sudan, is available for purchase online. The book will be also available in East African stores earlier next month. It's published by One World Publications. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, authorities in Tonj have banned customary courts. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the ideal presidential term limit and why?
My ideal presidential term should be 10 years because it will enable whoever becomes president to be able to accomplish his vision and mission for the country.
4 to 5 years, because for that kind of period, someone will have had enough time to implement his plans, because, you know, development is a journey.
I think a 4-year term is okay.
I have to say 2 years. After the 2 years, we can see if he's good, then we're going to add another year.
To me, I see it should be just a life presidency. Just because when we give a president a term, there are certain strategies that can't be implemented.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. And today we are talking about malaria prevention. Malaria-carrying mosquitoes are becoming resistant to the insecticides used in bed nets to prevent disease. Researchers say it's important to stay ahead of the resistance to avoid what they are calling public health catastrophe. VOA's Jessica Bauman reports.
Bed nets treated with inexpensive pyrethroid insecticides are a main defense against biting malaria-carrying mosquitoes, and they have significantly cut down on the number of cases. The World Health Organization reports malaria infected an estimated 212 million people in 2015, killing some 429,000 of them. That represents a 21% drop in the incidence of infection between 2010 and 2015. But a new study finds the primary mosquito that harbors the parasite in southern Africa, Anopheles finestis, is rapidly becoming resistant to the insecticide. In at least one country, Mozambique, researchers found that 100% of A. finestis remained alive after direct exposure to the chemical. Charles Wonji, senior author of the study, published in the journal PLOS Genetics, says scientists also identified the resistance gene in the mosquito. Wonji is a mosquito geneticist at the School of Tropical Medicine in Liverpool. Speaking from Cameroon, He says identification of the gene will give scientists an important tool to monitor the spread of insect resistance throughout the continent.
That form of the gene is now very predominant in southern Africa, with the risk that if we do nothing, there is a chance that those control measures may not work against this type of mosquitoes.
Wanji says Aphanestis resistance to pyrethroid insecticides developed rapidly in about 8 years. To counter it, he says, other more expensive insecticides could be deployed to treat the bed nets, mentioning a compound called PDO that targets the gene killing the mosquitoes. He suggests other control efforts, such as eliminating mosquito larvae that inhabit standing pools of water, can also be redoubled. Wanji says other species of malaria-carrying mosquitoes, like Anopheles gambiae, are starting to become resistant to pyrethroids, although that is occurring through a different biological mechanism.
That's why we need to study all of these species to better understand how they adapt and to be in a strong position to implement appropriate and successful resistance management strategies.
In another just-released study in the journal The Lancet Infectious Diseases, scientists in Thailand have found widespread malaria parasite resistance to artemisinin, and combination therapies using artemisinin considered the best treatment. They say the development threatens global malaria control and eradication efforts. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Tonj Municipal Council authorities have banned 8 customary courts in Tonj Town. The authorities say the traditional chiefs who preside over some of the courts do not understand the limits of their jurisdiction. Tonj officials also say some of the customary courts have been imposing unnecessary fines on minor offenses. Santino Manut has the story for VOA from Tonj.
South Sudan customary courts resolve dispute on the basis of numerous and written tribal laws and operate side by side with statutory courts which are based on the Penal Code and other statutory laws. Tonj Municipal Council Mayor Joseph Anan Mador says a majority of customary courts were supposed to operate in rural Fayams and counties, but traditional chiefs who run the courts decided to relocate into town.
Most of them relinquished most of their duties that were supposed to be done at the level of counties and at the level of IAMs. Then they decided to come to town, which actually brought too much congestion in town. So I decided that such courts has to be reorganized.
Mador says officials will scrutinize the banned courts over the next week and those found to be competent will be allowed to operate. Blantino Dodd-Mill is a legal advisor to Tonj state officials. Mill says traditional chiefs do not follow procedures when they form the AA courts. He says the temporary ban on traditional courts will enable the Tonj Municipal Council to follow proper procedures in establishing courts for the area.
There are procedures stipulated in this law supposed to be followed before formation of this court. It happened that these procedures mentioned in the Local Government Act are not followed when these courts are formed. So this makes confusion to the citizens. They don't know which court is competent to try the certain cases.
Mel says some of the chiefs presiding over traditional courts do not know their powers or their jurisdiction.
We observe that there are some cases tried by the High Court, and after trying by High Court, the parties went down to the chiefs. So these cases are tried again by the local courts or customary law courts.
Instead of being tried again in the local courts, the cases are supposed to go to the Court of Appeal. Mel says Tonj state officials will allow only the High Court, 2 customary courts, the Bench Court, Town Court of Red in Tony Municipality. He says the state justice officials will train traditional leaders to preside over customary courts once they are selected. Traditional Chief Barnaba Bikor, who is deputy chairman of one of the ban customary courts, denies customary courts have overstepped their powers by trying criminal cases, as alleged by municipal council officials. Speaking in Arabic, Bikor says some plaintiffs take their cases to a customary court when they are not satisfied with the ruling in a statutory court.
The cases that come here from High Court, one comes and say, I need so and so, paying the court fees and analyzing the case that was solved by the judge, and we say we have opinion in it. But still we refer back the document to the judge and tell him he solved this case and it has been brought to us and this is our opinion.
Justin Lual, a member of Tony Municipal Legislative Council, says he supports the decision to ban some customary courts because they levy heavy fines on local people. Lual charges some chiefs have asked for up to 3,000 South Sudanese pounds as a fine for a minor offense.
I support this idea of restructuring the local courts because the local courts are messing up the cases here and there. We have realized that they are not acting up to their mandate as far as the justice is concerned.
Akut Mayom Akut is the chairman of one of traditional court called Tonya Special Court. Speaking in Dinka, Akut argues that abolishing customary courts denies venerable people the opportunity to assess justice and may lead to violence.
I think if local courts stop to operate completely, then there will be fighting between people who have dispute over issues. Someone whose property has been taken unlawfully will fight if there is no justice. My message to mayor is this: you have stopped the court, but you have not assessed the hearts of the people. Somebody will steal someone's property and they will fight.
Mel says under South Sudanese law, a first great judge in a statutory court is allowed to sentence an offender up to 7 years in prison or a fine not exceeding 5,000 South Sudanese pounds. He says the law allows a third-class judge, which is at the customary court level, to sentence an offender up to 1 year in prison or enforce a fine not exceeding 300 South Sudanese pounds. For VOA News, I'm Santino Manut Ayuel in Tony.
We now turn to Kenya, where confusion reigns over the status of the U.S. travel ban. Though a U.S. federal judge put the ban on hold, Somali and Sudanese refugees ready to fly to the United States have instead been sent back to Dadaab and Kakuma camps. Other refugees in the U.S. immigration process are worried about the effects of the ban, as we hear from VOA's Jill Craig, who visited some in Kakuma refugee camp.
President Donald Trump's travel ban and its legal challenges have caused much anxiety in the Kenyan refugee camps of Kakuma and Dadaab, where those slated for resettlement in the United States are unsure of their futures. The president has argued the temporary measures are necessary to keep the country safe from terrorism. Refugee organizations respond that refugees already are vigorously vetted. Here in Kakuma, 48-year-old Michael Abukasim Kuku, a refugee from Nuba, Sudan, was scheduled to fly to the Refugee Processing Center in Nairobi on January 30th. From there, he was to join his wife in Des Moines, Iowa. But the ban prevented his departure. He says, I felt really bad and it really affected me. When I was told the ban was there and we were not supposed to go, then that really gave me a hard time. Kuku received a phone call that he is to report to the International Organization for Migration office on February 17th for his flight to Nairobi. He is hopeful that this time he will be successful. Another Sudanese refugee, 24-year-old Abdulaziz Yasir Yahya from Darfur, also was scheduled to fly to Nairobi on January 30th for processing, and then to his new home in Tucson, Arizona. But he remains here. He says, I want to go to America because my homeland is still in war, and we are just living with no hope. So when I go to America, I might be able to go to school. Ahmed Omar Bihi has lived in refugee camps since 1992, when he fled warfare in Somalia. He lived in Dadaab until 2013, when he was transferred to Kakuma. Behe was told to expect his U.S. resettlement before March. Now, though, he hopes for the best.
My hope is Mr. Trump is changing his mind and the law will be prevail in order to release us from this harsh life.
Somali refugee Kali Abubakar Muhammad says she was scheduled to leave for her new home in St. Louis, Missouri on February 1st. Instead, however, she was sent back to Dadaab.
But we don't know the reason why people are doing this discrimination.
Yvonne Ndege is the UNHCR Kenya spokesperson.
Well, we're following very closely all the developments going on in the U.S., and the situation is obviously fluid and things are changing constantly. But UNHCR Kenya's understanding is that we are okay for the time being to continue resettling refugees in the United States whilst the legal issues in the United States are resolved.
A request for response from the IOM was not immediately returned. A State Department spokesperson said the processing of refugees is ongoing in Nairobi, including for travel to the United States. The ban suspended for 90 days entry into the United States by citizens from seven Muslim-majority countries where terrorist groups are active, including Somalia and Sudan. All refugees needed to wait 120 days, with the exception of Syrians, who would be barred from entry indefinitely. But for these refugees in Kenya, they hope the legalities can be sorted out and they can soon begin their lives in the United States. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kakuma, Kenya.
That report by Jill Craig brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Panda Chol Bor by Panchol Deng. We've been listening to Panchol Deng with the song Panda Chol Bor. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
the final call it, but in that